The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, the thing that feels very similar is this intransigent opposition among the political elite, I think, to really address major socioeconomic issues that are being opened up for whatever reason, whether in the United States or in the ancient republic, where there were, you know, the vast majority of the citizens of the state do have like legitimate needs and legitimate grievances. A lot of this was driven by new feelings of insecurity, where you used to have like, you know, your family plot of land and you would just pass it down through. This is all sort of being broken up and you don't have that security anymore. And the political elite doing nothing to actually govern or manage sort of the negative effects of their triumph. What it was a political and military triumph for the state of Rome led to all kinds of dislocation in the socioeconomic milieu of the poorer Romans. So in the United States today, I think that same thing is sort of happening.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 4th, 2017. The estimable Mike Duncan was in town last week. If you've never heard of him, that's because you don't listen to enough podcasts. Mike is the impresario behind the incredible History of Rome podcast, which ran for a number of years, and more recently, the Revolutions podcast, both of which I could not recommend more highly. More recently, he is the author of The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic. What does that have to do, you ask, with the Lawfare podcast? The answer is everything. We talked populisms, ancient and modern, of the sort that erode republican government. We talked about the relationship between the late republic in Rome and our current politics. We talked about whether we are in the storm before the storm, or whether American democratic government will do better than Rome did in the period Mike covers in this book. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 258, Populisms, Ancient and Modern, with Mike Duncan.
Let's start with an overview of the project. It's not a book about our contemporary situation. It's a book that you talk in the author's note at the beginning about, kind of tease the idea that it may have some relevance to our contemporary situation or beg comparisons to it. But it's actually a narrative history of a period of time in a different continent, in a different big power environment, in which many listeners of this podcast may have limited familiarity. So start by just telling us, what's the project you took on and what's the narrative trajectory of the story that you tell?
So there's two reasons why the book exists. Like when we were sitting around and I was trying to think, what could I possibly do for a book? Or what do I want to talk about in Roman history or in ancient history? And the first is that this period that I talk about, which is between about 146 BC and 78 BC, which is the two generations or so before Julius Caesar comes along, is a wildly undercovered period in Roman history in the popular presses. we all know about Julius Caesar. We all know about Mark Antony and Cleopatra. These are sort of out there in the popular imagination that people know about. And the fall of Rome is, or excuse me, the fall of the Republic is this really big deal event in world history. But for whatever reason, the two generations that preceded the fall of the Republic that really sets up all the conditions that made it possible for Caesar and Pompey and Crassus to come in and wreck the thing, there's very few books about this. The Gracchi brothers, Marius and Sulla, are as important to the history, not just of the Republic, but the entire Roman Empire, as Julius Caesar was. But no book exists that will explain how, not the end of the end of the Republic, but the beginning of the end of the Republic, which is all on its own a really important part of the story of Rome to understand how the Republic falls apart. The other part of it is that while I was doing the History of Rome podcast, you know, everybody would always ask me, like, where are, like, is the United States Rome? Is are we the next Roman Empire? And if so, are we following a similar historical trajectory? And, you know, if these questions are going to be asked and there's no avoiding the question, then we should sit down and try to figure out where it is, yeah, on the timeline that we are. Are we in the early days of, you know, are we at the early point where we're just founding our society? Like, no, that was a long time ago. We had colonization. We had, you know, we had the founding of the Republic comes after we overthrow the kings. This all happens hundreds of years ago in American history. Are we just emerging as a regional power or a global power? We're not just now emerging as a global power. We already did that. We did that back in the 20th century. But has the Republic fallen and been taken over by dictators? You know, despite what some hysterical commentators claim, and we always claim that the other party's president is a dictator and acting as a dictator, but the Republic has not yet fallen. So we have to be somewhere in between those great wars of conquest and the rise of the Caesars, which is this period that is the beginning of the end of the Republic. And there are enough then historical echoes and problems that the Romans were dealing with during this period that are similar to, I think, some of the things that we're dealing with today.
All right. So walk us through where this story begins and where it ends, and with sort of specific reference to the role of what we can ahistorically call populist movements, which, of course, is where the word populist comes from. So it's not entirely ahistorical, but what did ancient populism look like, and what were its grievances and concerns?
So the book really begins with the imperial triumph of the Roman Republic, where they have decided that they've already defeated the Carthaginians, really, and it's the Romans making a decision that we are going to move from being the strongest power in the Mediterranean world to being the imperial power of the Mediterranean world. They directly annexed Greece. They directly annexed North Africa. They had already annexed Spain. So now they directly rule most of the Western Mediterranean. The legions that had gone out a conquering through all of these decades were bringing wealth back to Italy on an unimaginable scale. We're talking, you know, hundreds of thousands of gold coins, hundreds of thousands of silver coins. Some consul's going to come back from Spain with 80,000 pounds of raw silver. You're talking about the wealth of the Mediterranean really starting to concentrate in the Italian peninsula, and then really specifically in Rome, and then even more specifically on the Palatine Hill, which is where the wealthy senatorial elite, the nobility of Rome, were living, because they were the consuls, they were the generals, and so they were in control of the state treasury, and they were in control of their own personal fortunes. So you have all this wealth that is coming into Italy on a scale that the austere ancestors of the early, you know, the early republicans would not have even been able to contemplate how much wealth is coming in. It's all being concentrated in the hands of this tiny minority in the Senate. At the same time, the soldiers that have been conscripted into the army, the citizen farmers, the poorer citizen farmers, are coming back from in this same era of imperial triumph, and they're being ruined by this. They're personally facing economic ruin, not economic success, and their farms are falling into disrepair. Their senatorial neighbors are increasing the size of their estates and turning it towards more commercial purposes. So a small farmer is simply unable to compete with their richer neighbor. And so this imperial triumph leads to sort of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer.
And as well, a kind of a interesting analog to globalization and consolidation of wealth, right?
Right. And so where, like, you even look, I mean, just to touch on, say, the last 8 to 10 years of Western economics or American history, we've had a quote-unquote recovery since the Great Recession, but I think, you know, every graph that I've ever looked at will show you that most of the quote-unquote gains to GDP are, they're going towards the top 10% or the top 1%, whereas the wages of the average American worker are pretty stagnant, or even their purchasing power is falling. So we've all identified that as a source of great resentment in the American situation, and something that's exploitable, as the populace would exploit it. And the same thing was happening in Rome at the time. You have all these people that are being dispossessed of their farms. They're not doing as well as their fathers were and as their grandfathers were. And they're also being kicked out into a labor market that is also increasingly populated with slaves, because the other thing that the rich senatorial nobility is doing with their wealth, in addition to buying up as much land as they possibly can, is they're buying slaves and bringing those slaves into Italy. And slaves are now doing the work in the fields. The slaves are now doing the work in the mines. The slaves are, if you're a skilled artisan slave, you're doing arts and crafts in the urban centers and producing profit for their owners. So you have all of these poor Romans who are facing, they've been dispossessed of their property, and they're facing a labor market that's flooded with slaves. Well, they have now a lot of resentment and a lot of legitimate grievances, and they are very open to this new style of Roman politics, which is making direct appeals to the lower classes and to the masses, and having an ambitious noble look out and say, well, hey, you know, a path to power for me is to promise these dispossessed poor citizens, I'm going to give you land. We're literally going to take land from the rich, and we're going to divvy it up, and we're going to give it to you. Going to the urban plebs, who they can't feed themselves. They're entirely dependent on grain coming in from the fields or from Sicily or from North Africa. You know, once you get one bad shipment of grain, you're facing famine and skyrocketing prices inside of the urban centers, inside of Rome in particular. And so a noble could say, look, I'm going to have the state treasury subsidize the grain to maintain some kind of price stability. And as the Republic goes on, that's ultimately going to transform into what we all famously know as like the bread and circuses, which is you just cover their food costs. You have the state pay for the food. You make these promises to these voters. They all had the vote. You know, there was a democratic element that was quite powerful in the early late republic. That's not an oxymoron, but it is the early late republic. This is very powerful, and this creates a new way to achieve personal power, is by making these direct appeals to the resentful lower classes.
Okay, so who are the, give us the sort of thumbnail version of the populist leaders and movements that you cover over the trajectory of the book. What's for the person who's not familiar with this history, even in broad strokes, take us from the destruction of Carthage to the period that they are familiar with, of the sort of rise of Caesar.
Well, it really clearly starts with the Gracchi brothers, who is, at least as a name, is something that a lot of people are familiar with. It's Tiberius Gracchus and his younger brother Gaius Gracchus were the first, I think, faces of, you know, Tiberius Gracchus is the first to introduce one of these great land redistribution bills, which is, you know, the rich have too much. The poor citizens are being dispossessed of their land. It's making it actually very difficult to conscript for the legions. So he's going to make this promise. We're going to divvy up some land for the rich, and we're going to give it to the poor. That becomes one sort of permanent kernel of the populist appeal that is going to be, it's going to be a recurring theme in the 110s and then the 100s, the 90s, the 80s BC, until really the end of the book, is this issue of land redistribution. Gaius Gracchus introduces a whole slate of reforms. He's trying to bring out building projects. He wants to build new roads. He wants to build new colonies. This is going to create jobs for a lot of these people who have been dispossessed. This is going to create wealth for the sort of the sub-senatorial classes, which is, they're called the equestrian class. This is going to create a lot of wealth for them, so that makes it very popular. But what the Gracchi brothers were up to was was really a project of genuine reform, where I think that they were trying to use these issues and these appeals, yes, as a means to power, but also because they could see that there was an imbalance that was setting in after the imperial triumph of 146, where all of the land, all of the power, all of the wealth is concentrated in the hands of a very few people. And it's, you know, if we don't do something to relieve this pressure, this populist pressure, it could smash the whole state to pieces. And that's where you start to get to once the Gracchi brothers meet with their very untimely end. I don't want to do, you know, spoiler alerts, but just so you know, it doesn't end well for the Gracchi brothers. They both wind up dead because the Senate is really resistant to the idea of reform. And this leads to recurring cycles of a real confrontational style of politics and leaving the field open to leaders and men who don't necessarily care about the reforms themselves. They just want to make the promises that will get all of these, you know, resentful lower classes on their side. And you can say to these people, look, I know what your problems are. I know how to solve your problems, and I know who's to blame for your problems, and it just so happens to be my personal enemies who are to blame for all of your problems. And you can use that energy cynically, as a demagogue would, to just whip up support and use it to smash your own personal enemies, which is, as you proceed through the book, we move from sort of genuine reformers who were interested in reforming the state to cynical demagogues who are now using, and it descends very quickly to armed mobs, people who are showing up to, like, we're going to get this not just by holding a vote or by convincing somebody to do what we want, but we're actually going to, like, beat them over the head with bench legs. Then it gets to organized mobs are being used to do all of this stuff. And now, by the end of the book, the whole thing descends into a mass civil war that almost destroys the Republic right there because of this confrontational style, where the Senate is not willing to let any reform happen to the state. The populace want reform to the state, or at least are constantly being promised. And beyond the scope of my book, I mean, Julius Caesar is in this populare tradition. He's absolutely going to be using the same rhetoric, the same coalitions that the earlier Gracchi had used. He's going to use the same tactics to ultimately destroy the Republic and set himself up as a dictator.
So when you look at this story compared to reading the newspaper in a contemporary sense, what are the salient aspects to you that feel familiar? And what are the salient aspects that feel like you're writing about a different time in a different place that has no bearing on our current situation?
Well, the thing that feels very similar is this intransigent opposition among the political elite, I think, to really address major socioeconomic issues that are being opened up for whatever reason, whether in the United States or in the ancient Republic, where there were, you know, the vast majority of the citizens of the state do have, like, legitimate needs and legitimate grievances. A lot of this was driven by new feelings of insecurity, where you used to have, like, you know, your family plot of land and you would just pass it down through. This is all sort of being broken up and you don't have that security anymore. And the political elite doing nothing to actually govern or manage the sort of the negative effects of their triumph. What was a political and military triumph for the state of Rome led to all kinds of dislocation in the socioeconomic milieu of the poorer Romans. So in the United States today, I think that same thing is sort of happening. I think that there is a real problem with Washington, D.C. not necessarily addressing what we can all agree on, at, you know, whether it's healthcare or whether it's, you know, people having stable jobs, that there is at least a feeling that Washington, D.C. is completely failing in its obligation and its responsibility to govern the country, the whole country, for 350 million people, not just for the people who are giving them campaign donations, which is, I think, a lot of what is driving. I think it drove both the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, and I think it's a lot of what was driving Trump's message during the 2016 election. And on top of all of that, the last thing I'll say that I think is very similar is that a great deal of what the Senate was resisting back in the Republican days was not just, oh, I don't want to do this reform because I don't think it's a good thing, or because, you know, I don't think we need to do anything. It was a lot of, and especially with the Gracchi brothers, if Gaius Gracchus had been allowed to fulfill all of his reform programs, or if Tiberius Gracchus had successfully redistributed land from the rich to the poor, it would have made Tiberius Gracchus very powerful inside the Senate. He would have become very popular. He would have had more influence. He would have surpassed his rivals. And they couldn't, for very simple political reasons inside the Senate, they couldn't afford to let the Gracchi brothers have a win. And I see that going on all the time, where almost the issues themselves become secondary to, oh, you're in the other party, so I can't let you have this, because then you would be able to campaign on it as a positive thing that your party was able to accomplish, and so I have to deny you for that reason. So it's this very limited focus on, you know, what is today partisan advantage, and what would have been in the late Republic sort of clan advantage, because they didn't really have political parties in any meaningful sense. It was a clash of rivals. But the same dynamic is at play, where you have to deny your rival something positive, otherwise they're going to have slightly more power than you. And you just feel like maybe we could open up our vision just a little bit, and things would be... So I see that as a similarity. Differences are that there is, on having said all of that, the Romans were had a very conservative outlook on life, like a very small c conservative outlook on life, where they were challenged not just by letting a rival have more political power, but also just the idea of reform and change was sort of anathema to their whole worldview. They wanted things to be similar. They wanted today to be like yesterday. They wanted tomorrow to be like today. They wanted to keep things the same going forward. And the United States and the West generally, especially after the Enlightenment era, once we introduced this idea of progress and reform and change as almost an inherently good thing to pursue, because, you know, we always want to build the better mousetrap, right? We look at however things are, and we'd like to change them and improve them. The Romans were completely opposed to this notion of change and improvement. I mean, it's kind of well known that in the library at Alexandria, there was a working steam engine, and just like nobody ever took advantage of it, because they never sat around and said like, oh, well, how can we make it so we don't need horses and slaves anymore? They just didn't care about that kind of technological progressive improvement, which we take for granted as something that is worth pursuing. So I think there is a big difference in the worldview between the Romans and, you know, contemporary Americans.
So I want to focus on two other potential similarities and just get your sense of whether you think the historical analogy is valid or partially valid or invalid. One is the rise of political violence. And one of the themes in this book is that, you know, the mob becomes a significant feature of Roman political life. And, you know, I would not say that the mob has become a significant feature of American political life right now. On the other hand, we have seen violence at political rallies of a type that, and sort of candidate incitement of such violence of a type that is pretty novel in our recent political history anyway. And we've also seen Charlottesville-like incidents that are not self-radicalized or, groups are sort of taking matters into their own hands. And I'm wondering how early, late Republic that feels to you.
Well, you know, the theme of political violence, I think, is true. When I started writing the book, you know, we weren't quite there yet. As I was writing the book, which is over the campaign of 2016, you do start to have Donald Trump being like, you know, back in the good old days, we used to be able to kick the crap out of these people. And, oh, yeah, if you punch that protester in the face, I'll pay your legal bills. That is incredibly novel for, as you say, for a presidential candidate to be more or less encouraging his supporters to physically assault their political enemies. It's it's hard, you can't quite say that there's never been political violence in the United States, because there's like three categories of political violence, which is there's the one which is like an uprising where the dispossessed are fighting against the state, which, you know, we saw like back in the 60s, there was the Weather Underground. There have been various like violent.
And we've had top down violence.
And that's the other part of it is we've definitely had our fair share of top down violence, which is the state using its monopoly on the use of force to like repress either. Certainly we saw it with the entire history of the African American population. We've seen it with most racial minorities and union groups through the 19th century. But I do think it's true that we've more or less avoided these like this third category, which is the clashes of parties or the clashes of partisan groups, where we don't really have you're the Democrats and you're the Republicans, and then you both have like paramilitary wings where we're going to literally try to clear your side out with clubs or with guns. If we're going to have a vote, we're going to have our guys with, you know, AK-47s or AR-15. I guess it's AR-15. I just dated myself a little bit. Back when I was a kid, it was always the AK-47. Ringing a voting booth and preventing the other party from voting. You know, we haven't gotten to that part yet. But that is, I think, the novel bit of political violence that is something that is we are starting to fear, I think, quite legitimately. Because you have Trump, and Trump was encouraging his voters to be violent. There is, you know, the Antifa are, you know, I think they're incredibly misguided about what they're trying to do, and they are going out there and they're trying to beat up, you know, their political opponents. So it's that sort of on an equal level is definitely something to watch out for. It's nice that we have it. Honestly, 2016 turned out to be less violent than I would have thought. I mean, going into it was at Cleveland, right? Was the Republican National Convention, and I really was bracing for that to be as bad or worse than like the 68 Democratic National Convention. I really thought that there would be, it was hard to see how there wouldn't be major violent clashes out in front of that building. And, you know, kind of thank God it didn't happen. But it's definitely the top is being let off the lid of Pandora's box in a way that is not a good thing. And we all need to more or less reject the notion of using violence to advance our own political goals.
So the other area where I am just kind of fascinated by the appropriateness or lack thereof of parallels is in the personalities of these populist demagogues. And you describe the Gracchi brothers as, you know, whether sincerely or not, genuinely tapping something important in a sort of reformist vein. But certainly some of the people who came later are much more obviously just substanceless demagogues who are kind of tapping into a vein. And when you describe the current environment, you describe the inability of entrenched elites to address a set of legitimate grievances and economic dislocations. So my question is, to what extent should we see the populares and the sort of populist movements of that time as simply demagogic individuals who are tapping a reformist instinct that, you know, should have had more legs than it did? And to what extent is that a reasonable account of our own situation now? Or should we understand these charismatic individuals more in the vein of the Gracchi brothers as people who have important messages that we should be, you know, sort of less resistant to?
I think the very first thing that any member of these entrenched elites are going to say when they're challenged for, like, hey, we need to make some changes. We got some people with some bad beefs here, and we need to do something to help these people, or at least address their grievances, is that the entrenched elites are going to paint all of it equally as merely cynical demagoguery, right? They're gonna treat everything from the far left at Bernie Sanders to the far right at Donald Trump as basically the same, like, oh, they're promising, you know, 10,000 unicorns and it's all just a cynical power grab and, you know, don't listen to them. When you do that, you do make it difficult to differentiate between somebody who's doing it cynically just to grab power and somebody who wants to genuinely address the grievances that, you know, the country has. I mean, we're a country of 350 million people. A lot of them are feeling like they've been left behind, not just coal miners in West Virginia, but, I mean, I'm talking like hotel workers in San Jose and middle managers who no longer have any kind of job security. They can be laid off at any time. There's a lot of just like genuine insecurity out there. And when you inside what would have been the Senate at the time, and now, you know, let's say the Acela Corridor, whatever like shorthand you want to use for the entrenched political and economic elite in the United States, if they constantly turn around and only say all of these people are making demagogic appeals, we know that demagoguery is bad. We know that we know that they're never going to be able to deliver on their promises. So don't listen to them. Let's just keep going about our business as we're going about it, because we know that it works pretty well. And, you know, it's good for us at least. I think that really deeply threatens the legitimacy of the entire political structure if it refuses to see the difference between real and necessary reform and somebody who's just doing it for cynical reasons. I think putting your head in the sand is not going to solve this problem. And this is what happened to the Senate. Like, eventually they resisted it for so long that the sheer force of it just wound up blowing the whole system over. And then the Republic collapsed as a result.
All right. So when you look through history, you look at this period and you say, this is a situation where the elites could not find a sufficient set of reforms to let the air out of the balloon. And eventually the balloon pops in the civil wars of the genuinely end of the Republic, late Republic. You can say something similar about the French Revolution. You can say something similar about the late Russian Tsarist period. What's the counterexample? What's the situation when you look, so in your other life, you run a podcast about great revolutionary movements. What's the story that's not in that podcast because the elites got together and said, gosh, we're the early late Republic here. And that was just the Gracchi brothers who just did that thing. And, you know, there's amount of political violence that's happening that's really antithetical to our traditions and certainly has a lot of room to blossom into something very ugly. We better get our shit together or we're going to be Marius, you know, and then turn around and actually do it in a fashion that really lets the air out of the balloon. I could make a case for Franklin Delano Roosevelt being
Now you're taking my answer. Like, okay. You're asking this question. I'm sitting here with an answer. Now you're going to step all over my answer.
Make a case.
But that's one. And then there's a smaller one that I also want to talk about. But I, not just Franklin Roosevelt, but I think it's bookended by Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt, but they were representative of, you know, they're two most famous figures of this progressive movement that really cut through starting in like the 1890s, the early 1900s, you know, and then the other bookend of it is like the New Deal, where, you know, you go back to the 1880s and 1890s in this country. I mean, you were talking about like, this is peak Gilded Age. This is peak, I mean, what used to be called the Great Depression. Before the Great Depression, we had to rename it to the Long Depression. It went from 1873 to about the mid-1890s. Was actually a fairly similar economic situation that we're kind of dealing with today, which is you have this explosive recessive energy that we dealt with in like 2008. It's going to lead to a generation-long slowness of growth for, I think, the United States. I think that's something that's happening. So you have all of these same energies building up, and you have people that are working factory jobs that are terrible. You have the kids that are working. There's no standards for like the quality of water or the quality of food. there are challenges from anarchists and socialists and communists, and everybody is challenging the system. And then that's leading to sort of more authoritarian, you know, white supremacist tendencies to bat all this stuff down. What cuts through all of this is progressivism, which was saying, like, look, we can keep the same level of, we can keep the same Republican values that we have. We can keep the civil liberties that we cherish. We can keep the basic model, but like, we need to start addressing some of these issues, and it's okay for the government to come in and regulate what is in the meat. We can say, look, you can't work a kid who's 5 years old. That's just not going to fly. We're just going to make that illegal. It's okay because the state, the government is not some like foreign entity that's ruling over us. It really is an expression of what it is that the people want, and it ought to serve the people's interests in that way. That's what we all very naturally consider to be the role of a Republican government, a small R Republican government, is to serve the needs of its people. And I do think that that progressive movement really cut through what was, the Bryan-level populace out in the West and the more aggressively anarchistic forces in the cities. We got through that in one piece. And I think that it's quite true that we got through that in one piece. So that would be one answer, which I think we could have avoided a revolution. The other is a very specific one that I'm just covering now because I'm in the revolutions of 1848, where the only little bit of background that I'll give about this is, especially in France, was the July monarchy was a constitutional monarchy, and they had voting, and they had an assembly, and they had the equivalent of a Senate, but only a very tiny minority of people were allowed to vote. Only like a couple of 100,000 voters in a country of 30 million people. And more people wanted the vote. More people wanted to get in on this. And the government just kept resisting the idea. And they said, no, we're not going to expand the vote. And that particular issue of voting rights winds up blowing up the entire monarchy in 1848 and triggering what was then an entire year's worth of revolution, liberal democratic revolution across Europe. It all blew up. A place where it did not blow up was in Britain. Britain was not consumed by the revolutions of 1848. And I think at least in a major way, it goes back to the reform bills of, let's make sure I get, I think it's 1832, if I get this exactly right, where they said, yeah, more people are going to be allowed to vote. Yes, we'll open up the franchise. We'll start, you know, all of those pressures that built up and exploded across the English Channel in France did not blow up in Britain because 10, 15 years earlier, they had already addressed the issue and taken it off the table. It was not a source of revolutionary energy.
So when you were studiously good in the book about not addressing this question, and I want to put you on the spot. In the book, you don't answer the question, which you do pose, are we in a period that is the early late republic? And I'm going to formulate that question a little bit differently, which is, when you look at America today, do you see more analog to the early late republic, to Britain in 1848, to the United States in the period starting in the Gilded Age and ending in the New Deal? And are you fundamentally optimistic as you look back at these periods of history, or are you fundamentally pessimistic and nervous?
Well, let's say I'm nervously optimistic. If I could just, I can combine those two into one. I'm very nervous. I mean, it's not an overreaction to be deeply concerned about the things that we're watching happen in American politics. I don't think that there's a place for telling people, oh, you're just being hysterical, right? No, there's a lot that's going wrong right now. There's a lot of demons that are being let out of a lot of boxes that they had been kept in that are starting to circulate around out there. So there's a very real possibility it could go bad. I think that it's early enough along in the process, and there are examples, like we were just talking about, there are examples of sort of avoiding any kind of inevitable slide into destruction. So my hope is that, and again, the book is a narrative history of 50, 60 years of Roman history. To read it and to contemplate it and to think about it on, you know, if we're not careful, it can fall into this. I think that it would just, maybe that alone would help us not fall into it. Just knowing that it is a possibility that, like, no, it, there's, there, I've studied thousands and thousands of years of political history. Nothing is going to last forever. Nothing is guaranteed to be the same as it was when you were born. Like, there can be complacency that is quite frightening for me to think, oh, well, this is the way it's always been. Don't worry, nothing ever bad is ever going to happen because nothing bad has happened in my lifetime. That is not the best attitude to take because lots of bad things can happen, and they always happen to people who did not think that any bad thing could happen to them. It was part of the reason why they were so complacent. So I think that our particular political age calls for anything but complacency, and it calls for really grappling with the forces that are starting to pull America apart from itself and try to figure out how we can knit it back together and come back together and start to address some of the problems that have opened up. I think we can pull out of it. It's early enough along. I'm not fatalistic about it at all, but it is certainly not something that is going to be resolved all on its own magically by doing nothing about it. I think we all owe it to each other as citizens of the country to say, like, no, we need to step into this. And if our age has to be significantly more engaged civically than the next generation, then I guess that's just our burden to bear, and we should bear it and get on with it. We should get on with the program of bearing this burden of citizenship that we owe to each other.
The book is The Storm Before the Storm. The podcast is, I suppose, if you want to go back, The History of Rome, more contemporarily, Revolutions. I recommend all three extremely highly. Mike Duncan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Mike Duncan for letting me know he was in town and at Politics and Prose and willing to sit down. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast, so go to iTunes and leave us that rating. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only, the inimitable Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.